From Utah Public Radio, this is Undisciplined. I'm Matthew LaPlante. Coral reefs cover less than 1% of the ocean floor, but about 25% of all ocean life lives among the corals. These are keystone species, but they're disappearing, and it's happening quickly. Since 2009, about 15% of corals have died, and by some estimates, ocean reefs will decline up to 90% if average global air temperatures warm by 1.5 degrees Celsius above the last century. And we're almost there. 2023 was the warmest year on record, at just under 1.2 degrees Celsius above the 20th century average. Because we've lost so much already, and because we have such precious little time to change this trajectory, some scientists are turning their efforts toward collecting and preserving samples of reefs from all around the world, freezing coral germ cells in government repositories so that we have a stockpile to use to replenish what's lost. Mary Hagedorn is a leader in a global network of scientists focused on cryopreservation of marine species. In just the past few years, the Reef Recovery Initiative has created a world-class genomic library for coral reefs, an ocean and a frozen repository that includes hundreds of species of coral. Hagedorn works for the Smithsonian, which most people probably associate with its vast collections of non-living artifacts, but the world's largest museum has taken a leading role in this work, becoming the first major museum in the world to create and hold frozen collections for a wide variety of organisms, especially for coral reefs. Hagedorn says if we manage these repositories effectively, they can help offset threats to the Earth's reefs on a global scale. These frozen assets can be used today, 10 years, or even 100 years from now to help reseed the oceans and restore living reefs. Mary Hagedorn, welcome.
Matthew, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Mary, when I first heard of this effort, I thought, okay, well, this makes sense. This is sort of a combination of the doomsday seed repositories that we have all around the world, and then the captive breeding programs that we also do all around the world in zoos and animal sanctuaries. And, you know, like, it doesn't sound so hard. There are like 800 species of reef-building hard corals. So we just go out and we collect samples of these, we throw them into a freezer, and there you have it. It's not that simple, though, right? Like I haven't just solved the coral problem.
Well, in theory, you have. In practice, it's much harder because they are the most restricted animals on Earth in terms of the reproduction. So if you want to work on, you know, coral sperm or coral embryos, they have to reproduce. And most species of coral only reproduce two to three nights a year in some of the most remote areas on Earth that are subject to all sorts of hurricanes and cyclones. And so you can be ready to go and, you know, a hurricane will drive you off the reef and you have to come back next year and try again.
So two nights a year, do we know when those two, like when we put it on a calendar, or is it kind of random? I know there's something to do with the phase of the moon.
In Hawaii, where we know where many of the species spawn, we know their spawning cycle. We actually do make a spawning calendar the year before, and we know down to practically the hour, or actually it's even more precise than that. We know it to the half hour. But in most of the areas of the world, we do not know when those corals spawn. We can guess that they spawn during warmer spring and summer months generally, but we wouldn't know when to be there to collect that material unless, you know, we had done some research on that area ahead of time. But like in Indonesia, that is largely not the case.
Okay. And the reason why we need to be there when they're spawning specifically is because that's the material that at this time, and we'll get into this in a little bit here, what we might be able to do in the future, but at this time, that's the material that we know that we can successfully cryopreserve.
For humans, we can cryopreserve human sperm and human embryos. We have a similar capacity for coral.
And so on these 2 days a year for many of these species, you have to be in the right place. You have to be at the right time with the right equipment. Tell me about what that all entails.
So it's moving a small fertility clinic onto the beach, basically. And so you have to have equipment that, you know, you have to be able to get liquid nitrogen, which is often the stumbling point. And you also need electricity. You need to have boats and divers and you know, or you need to have running water to keep coral in. We work out a lot of our techniques in Hawaii. And in Hawaii, we have the best of both worlds because we have coral reefs at our doorstep and we have a very modern marine facility. It's very quick to go out and get our corals, and we have, you know, coral holding tanks, and we have electricity, and we have, you know, all the things that we need. So we can quickly develop our techniques there, and then we bring them around the world and modify them based on the area that we're going to. It's very high tech in terms of the science that we're applying, and the biophysics and the engineering is extremely high tech. But what we try to do is we try to make it as simple and as easy and as inexpensive as possible. And I'll give you an example. When we first started doing this, we made our very first, we make all our own equipment pretty much. The very first set of freezing tools that we made for coral sperm, we made from some aluminum piping and flip-flops, just a styrofoam chest for liquid nitrogen. So, I mean, we've gone much more high-tech than that. We use a 3D printer now, but we try to keep things under a couple $100 in terms of what we actually use and what people need to buy and use, so that it makes it, I mean, the whole idea is really to democratize our science so that anyone who wants to do this, you know, and professionally can do it, and we can walk them through it, and they might have the money to do it.
Yeah, because you're not going to be able to do all of this for all hard corals all around the world. This is going to need to be scalable at some point. We are racing against time right now, not only because of the fact that we're losing corals, but also because warming oceans and marine heat waves can stress those corals, and that makes their reproductive material too weak to be successfully cryopreserved.
Sadly, that's true. Sadly, that's very true. I think especially what we're seeing in Florida has been a galvanizing experience, both for me and I think many people in the United States. They just look at this and they look at it in horror, like watching a train, you know, a train wreck in slow motion. And it's just this horrible thing to see and watch and experience. And so it's galvanized me in many ways. I feel like I'm ready to, you say, okay, we'll do the best that we can, you know, with the modern tools that we have, and keep that sort of on the back burner and moving along. But we're going to start galvanizing the globe and, you know, and people around the world to help us do whatever we can, you know, because there's many ways you can take, you know, samples of coral and have them be a biorepository. And one is to have frozen samples. Now, frozen samples are dead, but if you do a good job, you can get DNA and RNA. You can get all of the bacteria that help coral live. Plus, you can get, you know, you can get information. You can have voucher samples that tell you about the skeleton. So you get all the genomics, and you get, you know, some health related things like the microbiome, plus some research material for the future. But then you can also take a fragment that you put into captivity or in human care. We can keep them in captivity for tens of years and keep them alive, and we can get them to reproduce, hopefully in the near future. So that's another aspect that we can do today, and we can, you know, and anyone can do that today. And then of course there's the cryopreservation, but we can layer on the cryopreservation as we go along, whether it's from captive animals or whether we strategically look at places around the world that are still doing well.
So this is like layering different strategies, different conservation strategies, and that creates some overlap, I assume, but it also allows us to target areas for conservation in ways that make the most sense for those areas. One of the ways that may make sense in the future, you know, to make this process easier, and to make it so that you don't have to just collect the material a couple of days a year, is to create a cryopreservation process for whole coral fragments. That could be done at any time of the year. You were part of a team that was the first to do this with Hawaiian stony corals. You published on that success last year in the journal Nature Communications. Have you had success with other coral species using that technique?
We haven't, and we're still actually trying to. It was a proof of concept And we're still really trying to get that to the point where we're ready to take it to the beach, you know. And so we're hoping in the next year that we will have that ready to go, but we're not quite there yet. And so we have a lot of engineers and biophysicists that are helping us on this problem, because as I mentioned to you a little bit earlier, it's a much more complex problem. When you cryopreserve a single cell, it's relatively easy. And for most species on Earth, we can do that easily and quickly. And when you get up to something like an embryo, which is much larger, the problem becomes more complex and more difficult. And there's very few species on Earth that have that ability. Coral is one of them. So we worked out that problem for coral. But as we get to something as large as a fragment that might be the size of your thumbnail, it is like freezing a human organ. It's very complex, it's large, and the problems of the biophysics of the freezing process are very, very complex. So we're still in the process of making that work 100% of the time. We have to make sure that we can freeze them and thaw them, but then we can rear them. So we can say, you know, if we take 100 corals and we freeze them, we know that we can bring back 30% or 40%, whatever that number might be, so that we can then use those numbers strategically in how we bank.
How close are we to having viable frozen samples of all the hard corals in the world? Obviously not fragments. We'd be talking about sperm and egg. Where are we at on that? There's about 800 to 1,000 species of hard coral, I think, around the world.
Correct. And that's just the warm water corals, so the shallow warm water corals. And we actually do have interest in deep sea corals as well. We are in the process of starting to mine the deep sea. And we're mining the deep sea for rare elements. And some of those are these things called nodules that have, I think they're manganese nodules. They accrete or they build up at a millimeter per million years. And but they're all over the ocean floor and people want them. In mining those, basically will suck up the ocean floor and get the nodules and then spew that sand and mud back down and creating this enormous plume of sediment in our oceans that will completely destabilize our deep sea. And we depend on the deep sea for the microbial ecology that's there. In many areas of the deep sea, it's covered with corals. So the question you're asking is a large one. We assume there's about 1,000, but no one really knows. Currently, the Coral Biobank Alliance has about 275 coral species in captivity that we know the species and we've tagged them and we're working on the genomics of them. We have over 50 species in terms of coral sperm in banks around the world. And we have about 3 or 4 species that are banked as larvae.
Mary, if our oceans change, and actually I really should say here, as our oceans change, there are some pretty substantial implications for regional ecologies and where reed seeding could even be possible. So we may have these corals in a biobank, but it might not be so easy as just like putting them back where they originally were, because these ecologies will have shifted. What's going to be the best way to make those sorts of decisions about what goes where and when? There seems to be like all of these really complex implications to this.
There definitely are. And some of them are scientific and some of them are social. And so in terms of the scientific ones, our oceans are changing, the temperatures are changing, the corals themselves are changing and adapting. And if we were going at a much slower pace with climate change and our overuse of fossil fuels, I have very good faith in coral's ability to adapt. And there probably will be some areas of the oceans where we see corals adapting and living. So, you know, I don't have a crystal ball. I don't know whether all corals will disappear in the next 100 years or not, but probably there will be far, far decreased in their populations. The great thing about coral, like if you have a fragment, you can grow it out and you can take, say, a 1-inch in diameter fragment And you can cut that into 20 pieces. So say we will get a lot of material if we perfect this coral fragment cryopreservation. We will get a lot of material from a single colony, say 10 samples, but you can grow those up and turn that practically into, 20,000 over time. And so you have a lot of material that you can play around with and test to see if it can go back in the water and when.
I kind of have this sense that a couple of generations from now, humans will get sort of this gift from their past, right? From you and everybody who's been doing this. And I hope they'll say, hey, that was really great of my grandparents to think about that.
We can only hope. It doesn't really matter. This earth is so incredibly magnificent, and anything that we can do to maintain its species and its ecosystems, in my mind, is gift enough for me. I hope that people will appreciate it, but I appreciate it enough to say, if we can do this and we know how to do it, why aren't we doing it? And so that's kind of my motivation to, sort of keep plugging ahead with this, even though it can be quite difficult.
So, it doesn't do us a lot of good to have this repository of coral species if all the animals that rely on these reefs die away. So in addition to this massive effort to try to save the reefs, you've also turned some of your attention to using cryopreservation to protect other members of the reef community. And successfully, I think, according to a recent study published in the journal Cryopreservation, you did this for an animal known as the collector urchin. Tell me about this project.
So the collector urchin is a tropical urchin. So the urchins are responsible. They're like the cows of the reef. They graze the reef and they keep it from being overgrown by algae. So having tropical urchins be cryopreserved is really important. And urchins only spawn for, they will spawn for 3 or 4 months of the year. And but the goal for this was to make sort of the agricultural process of this, or the aquacultural process of this, more robust. So they would have year-round access to frozen, larvae that they could take out of the freezer and keep their restoration processes going. We have an ongoing restoration process in Kaneohe Bay, where I work, where our bay became overgrown with algae and started smothering the reefs. And people had overgrazed or overharvested the urchins there. And so the state stepped in and said, okay, we're going to start growing these up. But they have a hiatus. They have about a 4 or 5 month hiatus where they can't grow anything because they don't have access to larvae. And so the goal would be to give them more access to larvae to keep the ecosystems going. And we hope to do this for the Caribbean as well, because they have similar issues with the diadema urchins there. Having frozen material can help you stabilize populations that are still in the wild but are having, are struggling. And I think that's a really good use of that material.
I suspect you are often asked about what happens if these cryo banks lose electricity. What happens?
Okay. It just happened to us. Unfortunately. So, we live on a rock in the ocean, right? 3,000 miles away from anything. So it's a fairly, fairly remote area, but it's still, we're not unsophisticated here in Hawaii. We have electricity and we have the means to get material here, but not quickly. And our bank was faltering. We knew it was faltering and we knew the piece that we needed. And we couldn't get the piece fast enough before we lost the bank. Now, we had moved a lot of the material, so it wasn't a complete loss, but it was a very sobering lesson. But one of the things that we're thinking about, and we'll have a paper coming out in a couple of weeks in Bioscience. I've been working with a group of colleagues around the U.S., and we are proposing a similar biorepository to the Svalbard Seed Vault. And as you know, that's the vault that was dug or was it's a mine or an old mine in Norway that was turned into this seed vault. And the great thing about it is it's the under the Arctic tundra, the seeds are held at minus 18 degrees Celsius, and they it's a perfect temperature for holding seeds that are dry, and they can stay at that temperature for decades. But there's no energy that's needed to keep that at minus 18 degrees. There's no place on Earth cold enough for cryopreserved material. And cryopreserved material is animal material. It is some plant material. There's about 10% of the plants that cannot be dried and must be cryopreserved, and microbes, among other things. We're proposing that we have a similar passive biorepository, and we're proposing that we're going to put it on the moon. Matthew, are you okay?
No, I'm so excited. This sounds incredible.
Yeah. So the idea that we're going to use stem cells. So I said we did not know how to cryopreserve most animals, but we're going to be using skin cells. So we're going to be taking skin samples from most animals on Earth, and it will include insects and all sorts of things. But to start out with, we started with fish because we know how to do that, and we've already got the samples at the Smithsonian. And we are going to try and test them, you know, get our packaging ready and make sure that we can test them for radiation and other things. And we hopefully will test them on the ISS. And then the idea would then be to send them to the southern pole of the moon, which is the southern pole has a lot of the they're called permanently shadowed regions. And these permanently shadowed regions are at some of them are at, you know, liquid nitrogen temperatures year round, so day and night and throughout the seasons. And so it's the right temperature. And if we can dig them, if we can have a similar kind of Svalbard, but we only need about 2 meters of, you know, lunar soil to cover the samples, and we will block, you know, most of the radiation that they might encounter. So the idea really is to start this repository to test it. The ISS may cycle down within the next 6 to 8 years. So we have a short period of time to try and test the cells on Earth and get them up, you know, into the ISS, and then, you know, test them back again on Earth to see how they did with radiation and microgravity. And then the goal would be to start actually doing this, you know, because we're going to go to the moon. You know, we have the Artemis project. People are going to be living on the moon. And there's all sorts of people planning to work in space. And so not only would this act as a repository for Earth, but it would also act as a repository, or I guess a grocery store for solar and other, you know, long space trips where they might need certain plants or microbes or whatever. I mean, they will take a lot. They probably take some of this material with them to Mars for terraforming Mars.
Oh my gosh, I love this idea.
Thank you. So that's coming out in the next couple of weeks in Bioscience.
Will you head back into the ocean and go diving for coral again anytime soon?
Oh yeah, absolutely. We're going to Florida, although that will be on land, and I'm going to Indonesia for probably the second time, but just to see how some of the corals are doing in Indonesia. To a large extent, you know, I just go and look to see how things look and, you know, kind of make an assessment. But, you know, there are divers that are far better divers than I am. And so I tend to be more of a cheering section for the divers than the actual diver myself. So I absolutely love to go in and see what's going on in terms of the health of the coral.
Well, Indonesia is really interesting, right? That's the center of the coral triangle. There's like 600 coral species right in a very short region.
Yes. And so, you know, I guess if someone said, you have a year to do this, and I had all the permits and people in the world ready to go, that's where, you know, I would go there. You'd have to, because that's the center, as you mentioned, of radiation for coral biodiversity. And, you know, would it be perfect? No, but it would give you, you know, you would be able to restart coral reefs, you know, in the oceans, and over, you know, geological time, they would expand, you know, just like we've had extinctions of coral reefs, you know, probably 4 or 5 in the history of our planet, where many of the species on Earth became extinct, and they come back. They come back differently, but, you know, if you had something from Indonesia, you could restart the ocean. It would take time, but over time, coral reefs would live.
That's Mary Hagedorn. She is a research scientist at the Smithsonian and a leader in a global network of scientists focused on cryopreservation of marine species called the Reef Recovery Initiative. Mary Hagedorn, thank you so much.
My pleasure completely, Matt. It's been great talking to you today.
Undisciplined is a production of Utah Public Radio. And if you happen to live in Utah, you can listen to us on UPR every Thursday morning at 10:30. If you miss us, then you can listen to every episode of Undisciplined wherever you get your podcasts. Our program is supported by the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at Utah State University and from listeners like you. You can support our work at donate.nprstations.org/UPR. Our producer is Reagan Edelman. Our theme music is Little Idea by Benjamin Dassault. And I'm Matthew LaPlante. Thanks for listening. Now go have big ideas.